Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monocle Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Di Mella. This week, it's all about Poland as we take a deep dive into the country's cuisine. Coming up, we discover a new book dedicated to the nation's sweet treats.
We always used to get a packet of plums coated in chocolate, so prunes, and I've recreated those in the book. You know, with a really good quality prune and a good quality chocolate, it takes it to the next level, really.
Also on the programme, we head to the renowned Polish restaurant Ognisko in London's South Kensington.
I didn't want to impose either on the club or the building anything kind of modern or kind of out of keeping. And so it's a kind of combination of some kind of quite traditional seating and everything else, but with a slightly contemporary feel.
Plus, we meet the co-founder of Bracz in Warsaw to find out more about the growing wine scene in Poland. All that here on The Menu on Monocle Radio. When you first think of Polish cuisine, your mind might go to savoury, comforting dishes such as pierogies, hearty soups and cabbage prepared in every which way. However, the country also has a solid tradition in making delicious baked goods and sweet treats. From cheesecake to chocolate-covered plums, many of these desserts speak of the variety of influences that have shaped the Central European country. Ren Behan has gathered the recipes of her grandmother and her heritage into a new book, The Sweet Polish Kitchen. It's a selection of both traditional and updated classics that's steeped in an endearing sense of nostalgia. Ren joined me in the studio to talk about how she went about collecting these recipes and shared the history of some of her favourite Polish sugary delicacies.
Both of my books and lots of my writing works just inspired by my Polish heritage. So I'm second generation. I was born here in the UK, but to Polish parents and grandparents. And so I've always kind of grown up with a very strong sense of Polish heritage and that sense of my roots and upbringing. And that's also very kind of deeply linked with a sense of nostalgia that my parents and grandparents in particular always had for kind of Poland. So I think the blueprint for doing something nostalgic was always there because it's very much been part of my life. Sweet, I think, you know, it resonates with lots of people because whenever I go travelling, I don't know what you're like, but I think bakeries, patisseries, they always catch your eye. You know, with restaurants, you have to go inside. You have to really look for something good. With a patisserie or a bakery, you know, you could literally walk and think, OK, I'm going to have that. And it might be something completely new or it might be something different. But I think, yeah, baking and sweet things is always very visually stimulating, isn't it? So I think that that's what I thought when I was writing it, that I wanted to remind myself of those trips and the donuts and wonderful cakes and cheesecakes and things that I might have had in Poland, as well as, you know, things growing up. So it just seemed like a good idea. I love baking. It's been a great activity to do at home. And also, I think that my first book, The Baking Chapter, was really popular. So lots of people sent me photos of their recipes, and it was very often from The Baking Chapter.
I feel like perhaps in the theme of this nostalgia, there's something that connects specifically to childhood about sweets anyway, right? Because it is this idea of like the sweet treats that you would have when you were a kid. And also the fact that often they're connected to special occasions. I think it's interesting that in the book, you make an explicit deal out of that. There's a whole section dedicated to carnival. There's a section dedicated to Easter and Christmas and other occasions. So is there a particular sense of nostalgia associated with sweet because of this childhood special memories element? And in this, what is the recipe in this that is most nostalgic and reminds you the most of childhood?
So I think when I kind of think back of my childhood, I don't overly think of sweets and cakes. But as you say, in those special occasions, celebrations, the Easter table, the Christmas table, you know, it's always a focal point and something that you really look forward to. My mum, you know, I always remember having a homemade cake for my birthdays, and I really appreciated that. When I look back at the photos now, I sort of think, oh, yeah. And actually, you know, they were based on a Polish tort recipe or a Polish sort of layer cake recipe. So I think, yeah, sweet food is linked to our childhood very often just because it's quite nice to have a sweet memory, isn't it? It's just very kind of like warming and a nice memory to think back on. I do talk in the book about some of the like the little sweets that I had. So it's not exclusively a baking book. There are some little sweet treats in there that are not bakes, but little krówki, which were the fudge sweets that we used to have. And I remember opening them and I could remember the wrappers that were yellow and the little sweets that were inside. They've had many incarnations over the years, but just recreating those at home was really special. We also have little biscuits that are kind of gingerbread biscuits called katarzynki. And I would remember having those on a Saturday after Polish school at the Polish club. And I'd go with my 10p or 15 pence at the time that they were and ask for a packet and sort of sit there. I could remember the squeakiness of the wrapper for some strange reason. So, yeah, there's often little things that kind of take you back to childhood and those little sweets. We always used to get a packet of plums coated in chocolate, so prunes, and I've recreated those in the book. You know, with a really good quality prune and a good quality chocolate, it takes it to the next level, really. So those little kind of sweets that I would have as a child kind of just have made a bit of an appearance for anybody that wants to have a go at something that's easy and not a bake. But yeah, there's plenty to explore.
Yeah, the plums covered in chocolate, I have to say, really, really caught my eye because I have an absolute taste for them.
Super easy.
I want to look at the fortunes of Polish food abroad in general and how sweet stuff fits into that. Mm-hmm. In the years since you wrote your first book, how have you seen the fortunes of Polish food fare internationally? And where do you think the appreciation for the cuisine is at right now? And do people really know the cuisine for its sweet things?
So that's a really good question. I have seen Polish food evolving over the years, kind of in the UK. We've very much moved on from the Polish corner shop that people might be familiar with and maybe a Polish cafe. There are some really good Polish restaurants to be found, and there's a couple in London that I mention in the book. I think if anybody after a kind of an Eastern European or Polish meal has got room for dessert, if you leave room for dessert or go there especially for dessert, then absolutely, I think it has its place. But desserts and sweet things also feature at certain times of the year. So things like Carnival, you might be more familiar now with the celebration of Polish Donut Day, where we all have at least one donut on Fat Thursday. So whereas in the UK, you might have pancakes, in Poland, we're more likely to have a donut. And those sort of things have kind of picked up a little popularity, and you might sort of be aware of that. Also, I just think it's really nice just to go into a cafe, whether you're in Poland or abroad, and just have a coffee. And it might be a pancake that's filled with a sweet cream cheese and raisins, or a layer cake that, you know, somebody's really gone to the trouble to make or bake. So I would say it's definitely worth keeping room for dessert or making that your priority when you go and visit a Polish restaurant or cafe. But certainly, especially in Poland, cafe culture is really prominent. So it's not unusual to just go out and have a sweet treat at, you know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, or to have something that's maybe a bit sweet with a child that comes home from school and that sort of thing. So I've actually seen breakfast recipes, fluffy pancakes with fruit inside them. So I think there's definitely an element of sweetness that comes into Polish food a lot. And I just think it's really nice to explore that through a sweet lens, really. And yeah, have a bit more prominence around the world for Polish food and Polish patisserie in particular.
What about Polish food in Poland? In the sense that there is a clear sense of nostalgia to the book, but the food that is presented is actually really modern. You know, it's kind of coated in this nostalgic air and nostalgic type and the beautiful tablecloths, but the bakes themselves are as modern as they come in many ways, even though they are traditional recipes, but they're presented in a very contemporary way. How do you see Polish food evolving back at home? Do you think that there is a particular wave in terms of making it more contemporary, and where is it going?
I'm really pleased that you've spotted that about the book, because, yeah, I think there's a fine balance between making something very nostalgic, very traditional, very authentic, and making something that's beautiful but has an appeal to people who are outside of Poland or may not have Polish roots. So it was really important to me to find that balance in the book of something that, yes, if you're Polish, you might see an element of nostalgia. This might be a cake that you would see and remember on your grandmother's table when you went to visit or something like that. But equally, there are some elements of modern bakes in there, as you say. So I've got a kind of riff on a cinnamon bun, but with a poppy seed paste. And there are a range of recipes that have sort of gluten-free, nut-free flours. Not all of that is not traditional. I mean, actually, we often bake with nut flours in Polish cakes and torts. So I think that it has a place at the moment because, as you've spotted, you know, you can find things in there that are familiar and yet are also very traditionally Polish. When I sort of visit Poland now, I do see a new wave of bakeries and patisseries. Certainly bakeries and that sort of artisan feel of, you know, going back to basics, back to roots, baking with sourdough, really taking that time over things, producing buns that are filled with blueberries or bilberries in the right time of year. And I do see that in Poland a lot. And, you know, I've had a good few trips going back recently, particularly for this book, where I've kind of, you know, picked up on micro bakeries around the bigger cities, you know, Warsaw and Krakow. So I do think that Polish patisserie and Polish baking and the whole genre is having a bit of an uplift at the moment in Poland. And there's certainly an exploration now in Poland of, you know, lots of different other types of patisserie and baking. There's lots of French influence and Italian influence. And I talk about that a little bit in the book and how that has come about from migrants and immigrants over the years. But there's a real sense at the moment that people are just going back to that real sense of traditional. And I think that that's what I wanted to tap into, as well as making it relevant for today.
Speaking of influence, this book actually taps a lot into history. You go and explain how so many of these recipes are linked to a very specific story that has its roots in history, it has its roots in real people. How did you research the book? And also, how do you think Polish baking speaks of the history of the nation as well?
In terms of influences in Polish food, yes, of course, there have been many, many influences over the years. There have been many border shifts. There have been lots of different waves of migration. What you might find in some recipes are perhaps more traditionally Eastern European. So with those flavours like the poppy seed and maybe the gingerbread that would have originally come from Toruń, that you do see influences from other countries, but I think you get that in every country from all types of baking. I mean, what is the true root of an apple charlotte cake? You know, yes, we kind of go back to France. But also, I think, I talk about in the book, we've had lots of foreign, we had a beautiful foreign queen, an Italian foreign queen, who is said to have really missed her home in Italy. And so brought to court, you know, lots of things from Italy that she missed. So we think that maybe citrus maybe came in that period. And I just think it's really nice to delve into those sort of stories and find out where things came from. I don't think anyone can ever really 100% pinpoint a recipe and say it came from this region at this time. You just have to go back and try and retrace the steps and see where things might have come from. I just think that's really interesting, isn't it?
And in a way, it's also a way of tracing the ups and downs of history as well, right? Because the history of the country itself is also made of so many ups and downs. And so there's like, there's a certain kind of indulgence in some of the recipes and then moments of more hardship in others. Like, how do you think that type of kind of modern history is witnessed through these bakes?
Well, I think you're right. Yes, there are periods in time and in history where there might be more decadence. I mean, I think I pretty much traced the Polish cheesecake, the classic sernik, back to maybe an early Viennese version of a cheesecake, traditionally with no base. So not like an American cheesecake where you have a crumbly base and then a filling. With Polish cheesecakes, it's either no base, bezpodel, or with a pastry base. So again, there's lots of, you know, even in one particular recipe, there are going to be lots of variations around it. I definitely think that through communist times, there was a different level of frugality. Not everything was available to everybody at all times. My own grandmother, who came from the Volyn region, so the eastern areas of Poland, and after the Second World War ended up being rehoused in a British resettlement camp. But she would save up her rations and then swap things for yeast and sugar and things like that. So really only to be able to make things that reminded her of Poland and of home. So I think there are, as you say, waves over time where people have to become more creative, and then other times when things are just purely in abundance. And that's why I think also with Polish baking, there's a big influence on seasonality. So lots of fruit in the cakes, lots of, like I said, bilberries, which are like wild blueberries or raspberries or strawberries, and cakes that are layered up with fresh fruits, more than I think maybe you find in other cuisines. So the time and the place and the availability of produce certainly is worth exploring in that sense. And hopefully I have done that a little bit through the book.
That was Ren Behan there speaking to me at Midori House. You're listening to The Menu. London is home to one of the largest Polish communities outside the country's borders, so it's only natural that shops and restaurants would pop up across the city to cater for a desire for a taste of home. Some of these outposts are delis packed with pickles and cheeses, some are down-to-earth eateries for homestyle cooking. Others have taken a refined look at their home country's cuisine. From its stately setting in West London, Ognisko has become the city's leading Polish restaurant. Originally opened in 1939 as a social club for Polish émigrés fleeing from the Nazi Soviet invasion, the restaurant remained an important hub for London's Polish community throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. In the early 2010s, it was refreshed by new owner John Woroniecki. Set inside a Victorian townhouse with high ceilings and candlelit tables, the kitchen creates stylish interpretations of Polish staples alongside fruity cocktails from the bar and, of course, punchy vodka too. Monocle's Julia Lasica talked to John Woroniecki about his take on tradition and why this space is so important for London's Polish residents.
Ognisko Polskie has been around since 1939. This building in Exhibition Road, a kind of big, beautiful, old Victorian townhouse, was given to the Poles during the war for use of the offices and emigres. And then at the end of the war, it stayed a members' club. And I remember coming as a child with my father, who'd come over during the war. He was in the army, stayed in the UK. And I remember it as being very, very different. It was full of the old emigres and the officers and the aristocracy. And it was a lot of kissing of hands and flirting with waitresses. And it struck me as being very, very different, especially in the mid-60s in England. And I kept on coming back here over the years. And it's kind of got a bit sadder and sadder and a bit shabby. And eventually, the building nearly got sold. And I then had the opportunity to come in and refurbish the main rooms and start a new restaurant and event space. And thankfully, it's been pretty successful. It was slow burn because we are kind of very invisible on the street here. And it had such a bad reputation that people didn't really want to come back. So over the years, we slowly built up a good client base. And at the moment, it's pretty busy. I wanted to respect, one, the building, but also the history of the kind of emigre Poles in the UK. So I didn't want to impose either on the club or the building anything kind of modern or kind of out of keeping with that kind of story. And the rooms are beautiful, so you don't really need to do much to them. You just need to let them speak for themselves and keep it very simple. And so it's a kind of combination of some kind of quite traditional mahogany bar and, you know, kind of quite traditional seating and everything else, but with a slightly contemporary feel. The great thing about Polish and other Central and Eastern European cuisines, at its heart, it's a very, very good country cooking, with a slight overlay of bourgeois French cooking from the 19th century, when a rather like Russia, where a lot of aristocrats would bring in French chefs, and so you'd have dishes that had a kind of Francophone style to them. But at its core is good country cooking. But there's a difference in the use of creating balances, sweet and sour, a lot of use of fruit, a lot of use of pickles, a lot of use of fermented things, which creates a sharpness and sweetness. So Poles obviously are famed for their dumplings, whether it's a pierogi, which are like a kind of half-moon ravioli filled with various different fillings, kopitka dumplings, which are rather like a kind of gnocchi. The soups as well are fantastic, good, hearty, some sour, some meaty, some very vegetable-based. And then, of course, the classic barsz, which is the borscht, the beetroot soup. And at its core, when it's made properly, it's made from fermented beetroots. So you've got that wonderful intensity of sourness coming through. I mean, I've been in the restaurant business for 35 years, various restaurants, and I've tried every single vodka known to man. And it struck me that vodkas have become very kind of samey, that partly due to the kind of monopoly and homogenization during the communist era, where there was a kind of single controlling business, but also the American legal classification of vodka, which up until recently was that it had to be odorless, colorless, flavorless, characterless spirit. And so every vodka brand was kind of fighting over a very small kind of battleground and saying how many times they're distilled. And so I did some research and realized that back in the 19th century, the early part of this century, a lot of distilleries would create vodkas that actually had a real point of difference, that had character, that had flavor, that had taste. And they tried to accentuate that. So we arrived at a production method that was very popular at that time, whereby you, to good grain spirits, we use 50% rye, 50% wheat. We add small quantities of pot still fruit spirits, plum and apple. And these fruit spirits give an amazing depth and complexity, natural sweetness to the spirit. And the other variants that we have come up with, as you say, the Tokaj cask aged, which is in homage to Starka, is extra amount of fruit spirits, about 10%, and then the wheat spirits, and then we age it in the sweet Tokaj cask for 18 months. And we have a small distillery in the ancient old market town called Sandomierz in the east of Poland, near the Ukrainian border. And that is right in the middle of the fruit-growing area of Poland. So amazing quality of apples and plums, a lot of old varietals which give a great intensity of flavor.
John Wernieski there, speaking to Monocle's Julia Lasica. This is The Menu. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Monica Lillis.
Last Sunday saw the return of the Cours de Café, or café race, to Paris in over a decade. Around 200 of the city's serving staff donned traditional aprons and white shirts, holding a round tray with a coffee, croissant and glass of water as they jogged nearly 2 kilometres around the city's streets. The traditional race was first held in 1914, but had been on hiatus since 2012 as a result of lack of funding. However, with the Olympics being held in the French capital this summer, City Hall officials decided to invest in it once again to promote the soft power of cafes in the country. Canada's maple syrup reserve has reached a 16-year low, raising questions about the future of the much-loved sweet staple. The reserve, located in Quebec, is also the world's only and is designed to hold around 60 million kilograms of the stuff at any given time. However, this year's supply was a mere 3 million kilograms. Experts link the shortage to climate change as well as an unprecedented rise in demand. And finally, researchers in Belgium have found a way to use artificial intelligence to improve the taste of beer. Scientists at the KU Leuven University used a sample of 250 commercial Belgian beers and adjusted their alcohol content, pH, and sugar levels using AI. A tasting panel of 16 participants sampled and scored the brews, which found an improvement in most of their ratings. The leader of the study, Professor Kevin Verstreppen, said that whilst the data model can help to optimise the drinks, the skill of brewers remains vital. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Chiara.
Thanks, Monica. You're listening to The Menu. We now head to the nation itself, which is one of the fastest growing players on the European winemaking scene. Although they might not be the most well-known choice, Polish wines of all kinds are turning heads and taste buds in many bars all over the continent. After honing their craft abroad on more traditional winemaking soil, a flourishing clutch of Polish vintners are bringing back this expertise to their homeland. Whether you're after a classic Sauvignon Blanc, a funky orange wine, or a summery glass of rosé, Poland now offers an incredibly wide range of top-quality bottles. Warsaw-based reporter Mateusz Mazzini sat down with Marcin Nowakowski, co-founder of Bracz, an all-Polish wine bar in the Praga district, to discuss the past, present and future of the Polish winemaking industry.
The idea of Bracz came from a couple of different reasons. Some of them are more emotional, and I would say that this is a passion for wine and a passion for a Polish wine, which is kind of a new discovery and a novelty, I would say globally, not only all over the world, but also in Poland. And the other reasons I would say are more rational, and that was serving the business, how it develops and how it grows, and very expressive dynamics of the Polish winemaking. So these are the two areas that we've decided to open Brač. Also, we kind of used something that is called like Slavic fantasy or Slavic imagination, and we've decided to pioneer in that area because we opened something that is quite unique. This is the only such place in Warsaw. We are first to explore this market and to open such a place. So yeah, these are the most important reasons that decided we opened Brač. And what is defining our aesthetics? I would say it's our patriotism, because we are selling and serving only Polish wines. We've decided to use only Polish design, and we focused on what is best, not only modern Polish design, because also we are using, for example, a Polish tableware from 60s and 70s. So we are trying to focus on what's cool in Poland, what's the coolest in Polish winemaking, and we are trying to serve that in the most Polish way that is possible.
Marcin, tell me a few things about the Polish winemaking industry in general, because for many of Monaco listeners, it will come across as quite a novelty. How big is the industry itself, and what do we Poles specialize in terms of making wines right now?
It's kind of hard to say how big it is, because it's not big on one hand and it's huge in the on the other hand. I think numbers would say the most easily. For the 2024, the number of Polish wineries is 570.
Almost. That's quite a lot.
That's quite a lot. But I think bigger is even dynamic of growing year by year, because in 2023, it was around 470. So we have almost 100 of new producers year by year. So the dynamic is huge. The market all over is not huge yet. It's getting bigger and bigger, but the dynamic is really very, very expressive. And this is one of the reasons that made us to open this place and to focus on Polish wines, because it's so expressive and the speed of growth is really huge.
So walk me through the list of your all-time best-selling wines here at Brač. What's dominating the charts in your offer?
So a couple of different routes. Because one thing that surprised me most, it's the most popular category in Brač is orange wines. So the most new one, the most brave one, and the most wild one. But it also correlates to the global trends. Like, orange wines are super popular all over the world. So a bit surprising for me, because I would say that Poles have a bit more controversial taste. But no, the orange one is the most popular. And it our guests love to try new things, love to experiment. But if I would pick some styles that Poland could be expert in terms of producing, I would say two categories. And one is the classic calm white wine with a bit more aromatics and super, super crisp and fresh. And the other category that is getting bigger and bigger is the sparkling wine produced by the traditional method. So the same method as in the champagnes, Franciacortas, Cremant, and so on. And some experts say that Poland actually could be the next big player after the England in terms of producing the sparkling wine by the traditional method. So I think this is the big opportunity for Poland to have some mark on the European map of winemaking.
Marcin Nowakowski, co-founder of Brač, thank you for the conversation. And those of you who are still interested but haven't explored Polish wine, be quick. It's very good and it's only going to get better.
That was Mateusz Mazzini reporting from Warsaw. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan and Lily Austin. Thanks for listening, and until next week.